Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Oh, hi. Usually I talk about our Patreon page right here, but I thought I'd give you a break from it this week. And if you're grateful for the break, make sure to sign up at patreon.com/Bob Zuska Show. I'm kidding. Not really. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Zuska Show.
Bob Zuska.
Bob! Bob! Bob!
The Bob Zuska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, September 22, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Zuska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, how you doing? My name is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, day 244, the Biden-Harris administration, 413 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobZuska and on Twitter at BobZuska_go. All right, so today we're going to rewind all the way back to April and my conversation with the great Bob Malone, one of my new favorites on our indie music playlist here. Bob's a keyboardist, he's a singer, he's a songwriter, he's a touring musician, he's a solo recording artist. Oh my God, he's performed and recorded with A-listers like Ringo Starr, Bruce Springsteen, Jackson Browne, Avril Lavigne, Bob Seger, and he's been part of John Fogerty's touring band since 2011. His brand new album is called Good People. It's out right now. Link in the description, bobmalone.com for more. Meantime, if you like what you hear today, don't forget to subscribe to our bonus content at patreon.com/Bob Zuska Show. So here's me and Bob and some live music in here, too. Oh, my God. This is a super fun one. Stick around. One of the topics that always comes up whenever I talk with indie musicians is, of course, the pandemic and the inability to go out on tour. How are you holding up through all of this? How are you making do through the pandemic and not being able to go anywhere?
Well, you know, I've been doing a show almost every week. Last year, 2020, I did a show every week, sometimes two.
Wow.
On stage it. And, you know, my fans tune in and they pay money and they watch the show. And it's really gotten me through this.
Wow. It's incredible.
It's been great. And I'm still doing them. I'm doing one Saturday. And so that's been my main outlet for playing live. I'm doing air quotes that you can't see. You know, that's been my live-ish performing since everything fell apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I get some royalty checks. I mean, I'm you know, my wife still has her job, so between all those things,
yeah,
we're okay. I mean, I've been pretty lucky overall. It's more of an existential crisis where I just like. Everything I've ever known has been just halted. Like I haven't not played live for this long since probably since I was 17, you know, like,
oh my God.
I've always played for a living, you know, my whole life. I've never stopped for this long. So like I remember taking I got married, you know, and my wife is like, this is like 20 years ago. And she's like, let's take a vacation. And I was horrified. I'm like, I don't take folk. If I stop working for 1 week, I'll never work again.
I know exactly what that is. I know exactly what
that's like.
That was me
for the first 15 years of my life. Like, I did nothing but just work.
Right, right.
So I took the vacation. I came back from the vacation, and everyone still took my calls, so I was shocked and horrified that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
yeah, right, you get back and you say, so that's what that's like. That's what
right,
this
it was
vacation
amazing.
Thing is. Yeah.
This what do you mean vacation?
Right, right, right. And so for this past year, that must have been though a great opportunity to start writing some music and getting some things down in the studio. Are you able to record at home, or do you record a lot of your solo work at a studio? Or
mostly, I go to studios. Yeah. I do some stuff at home, and actually, it was a terrible time for me creatively. Like this new record. Was all written before the pandemic. Everyone assumes it was written during because the songs are so of this time.
Yeah.
But I think I was just, all the kind of stuff that people are going through right now, I was going through it already kind of emotionally.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wrote about it. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, so it was... I found it incredibly hard to be creative during all this.
Difficult during the tragedy as you're kind of you're in the mindset of restriction and horrible news, just being bombarded with that, and that sort of tamps down your mojo for writing stuff?
Yeah, that does. Yeah. And just, I don't know, the disruption of my life made it hard to create.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't really put my finger on what it was. It's just, it's either coming to you or it's not coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't written a song during this thing yet, you know.
Was there a side of you who's going, you're going to yourself, what if this never ends? What if we're in this pandemic situation
for many,
many years?
I think that was part of it. Part of it was, and part of it, writing songs for me also is... because I'm going to play it for people, you know, which I could do online, you know, but so, I don't know. It was just a hard time. Never gone this long. I mean, what I did do was finish this album that's coming out.
Like, yeah.
We actually recorded the very last track on the day everything shut down.
Oh, my God.
We're in the studio. I finished my take of the song that's now on a record. And they're like, you know, okay. We have to leave now. Everything's shut down.
God, yeah.
Oh, man. So that worked out.
Right. Well, at least you got that in the nick of time. I guess that's a bit of an upside, huh?
Right. And then the guy who mixed it, Ross Hogarth, he has this old rig at home, and he mixed the record over the next few months. And, we didn't have to go anywhere for that. So,
what's the name of the record?
Good People.
Good. Oh, so it is. So you're going to call the record the same as the amazing, the incredible single that you put out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that song was out. That was the other thing, too. That song was out in 2019, and I was going to be putting my record out in 2020. It was kind of a preview of the thing, and that never happened. So.
I mean, since I played the single on my show, I have received nothing but piles and piles of emails and comments and DMs about...
That's great.
Holy crap, who is this guy Bob Malone, and where can I get this song? And so I'm directing all of my listeners.
Send me everything, because, you know, I have very low self-esteem, so every one of those will really help, you know.
So is this, I guess...
Imposter syndrome every morning, you know, I like... It would be nothing like some praise from strangers to get me through my day. So, please.
Hey, welcome to the club. Thank
Feel
you for joining.
I know, yeah.
So you're, we were talking before we started here. You're originally from New Jersey.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, obviously your home state has a long, long tradition of producing great musicians. When did becoming a professional musician enter your plans? When was that first spark when you realized, oh my God, I want to do this for a living?
I was 10.
Wow.
After about a year of piano lessons, I'd say the first 8 or 10 months of piano lessons, I was just some kid who hated piano lessons, right?
Yeah.
And nothing was happening. And then all of a sudden, literally like within a month or so, I just sat down and all of a sudden I could do it. And then after that point, I could not be stopped. I couldn't be torn away. And all I did was music, and all I thought about was music. And I was like, I'm going to be a musician. I never considered doing anything else ever. Like, it's nothing else has ever crossed my mind since I was 10 years old. So that was when.
Was it the music itself, or did you...
Jazz. You know, like a weather report and and Return to Forever. I don't know how I found these records as an 11-year-old. It wasn't like the kids at my school were listening to that stuff. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what, mid-late 70s at that point, right?
Yeah, it was about 79, 78, right? And I was not at all paying attention to anything popular. And then about at the age of 15, I discovered rock and roll. Then I was like, I really wanted to write songs. The epiphany there was about the communication aspect of writing a good song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that became really the thing I wanted to do well.
So I'm sure your parents must have been super supportive during that first 5 years from age 10 to age 15 pianist. That must have been something that they were over the moon with. And then suddenly maybe rock and roll comes along and they're going, okay, all right, hang on a second.
It was the opposite, actually. They weren't really into classical music or anything.
Huh.
I mean, they were very supportive just in general. And like, they were not musicians. They weren't people who knew any other musicians. This was an alien thing to them, 100%.
Yeah.
And they had to get over the idea that I would starve, you know. And they had, but they were very, really supportive. I mean, they paid for lessons. Came time to go to college. I'm like, I'm going to music school. And my dad was like, well, you know, apply for a couple of non-music schools just to have something to fall back on. It's almost like, he felt it was his duty. He knew I wasn't going to do it.
Yeah, you know, well, it is a rare thing. I mean, it is kind of a roll of the dice.
And I was set on it at such a young age that mm-hmm. I didn't, there was no room for options, basically.
Yeah.
But I did, by 16, 17, I had this band. I played on the weekends, and we made money, you know, a couple of $100 you know, in the 80s when you're a high school kid. That's quite a bit of dough.
Yeah.
For playing the piano. So then they saw at least the practical side was that, oh, yes, you can make money playing music.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if there's something in all parents' heads, because I went through the same thing, too, with, I think, 5 years of piano lessons. I got into the National Piano Guild and things like that. And that was fun for my parents because they thought, at least while I was playing piano, that was something more serious than playing guitar or screaming into a microphone. And
the
much
piano player was always like the dork in the band that, you know, kept everyone was too high to play. You know, they would crack the whip.
Right, right. But I mean, to come of age in the 70s and 80s, I mean, there was an embarrassment of riches when it came to great keyboardists in rock music. I mean, I'm a huge Rick Wakeman fan myself.
Yeah, he was one of my first big keyboard heroes.
Yeah, who were some of your others? Who were the people who were inspiring you?
I mean, Billy Joel is the first. I heard. I was like, I must do this. That was one of the first things I heard.
That's so cool.
You know,
The interesting thing about Billy Joel is he's playing piano as a songwriting accompaniment, as opposed to something that was, where keyboards were much more a feature of an overall band, or even as a solo artist. You look at keyboardists like Rick Wakeman or Keith Emerson, who are, you know, doing really crazy shit on the keyboard. And that's there's a big difference, I think, between the style of music that Billy Joel used keyboards for and piano, as opposed to some of those prog rockers, for example,
He would just flash stuff in during a song that was a song.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh, he's got chops. He's classically trained. Like, he's not that good looking. I could do this, you know. Like, the whole thing. Like, he shows it. He doesn't show it off all the time.
Yeah.
Like the prog guys.
Right.
But that's kind of what I aspired to. I didn't really want to show it off all the time. Although I loved Rick Wakeman. I used to sit and listen to Close to the Edge over and over again.
Oh, yeah. Incredible work, yeah.
I wasn't into prog so much as I was into Close to the Edge.
Right, and I think that is, like, yeah.
Some of it seemed silly to me, mm-hmm. even though the playing was always great. But that record, it was perfect in that it went right up to the edge of silly, but it didn't go over the line. So it was brave, and it worked.
Yeah,
you know? And that was what was so, like, singular about it.
So did you always feel like you were more on the rock and roll side of things as opposed to like especially in the first 5 years of the 80s, there was still this, there was a new wave movement that occurred, plus a lot of techno music and so on. Were you kind of experimenting in some of that stuff too, or is it mostly grounded in rock?
During that time, I was not that into the music that was actually happening at the time. Like, I was pretty immersed in everything from between 65 and 75 or so. Mm-hmm. I was just catching up on, what would come to be called classic rock,
Right, right.
It was all stuff that happened when I was 5 years old, And I was really in love with that, and not so much in love with the funny thing about the 80s is every song that was a hit when I was a teenager, many of which I did not like. I didn't buy the record. If it came on the radio, I turned it off. Mm-hmm. Yet I know all the words to all those songs, because when you're that age, that just seeps in there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, if they put on that Kaja Goo Goo song right now, I could sing along with the whole thing. And I'm like, why do I know this? Why is this taking up room in my brain?
Well, that's what I read about musicians like the late Neil Peart, who, for example, used to play drums along with just AM pop radio, despite the fact that he went on to become this prog and rock and roll drumming god, right? But he started out his formative years, he was just playing along with bubblegum pop, and that's how he kind of developed a vocabulary for playing all kinds of music. So that makes total sense that you were, at least experiencing some of that music in the 80s while not necessarily gravitating toward it.
I was into all kinds of things. I never really, and to this day, I don't really pledge allegiance to any particular genre, Mm-hmm. I mean, after all this, I discovered New Orleans music and roots music and all of that kind of stuff, and Ray Charles and blues music, and I mm-hmm. became really deeply immersed in that, like through the 90s. I again detached from pop culture and just, learned and became this roots guy,
Yeah,
so all that's in there on top of my classical training and my jazz fixation and my, Billy Joel, Elton John thing, right? They're all kind of mixed together. I discovered Dr. John, was a big influence, mm-hmm. and that whole piano style, I it's all kind of in part of my DNA of playing. Well, sometimes I get going pretty good, but it's still a little early for me back here in the West Coast. So I'll suddenly lose my train of thought. I'm like, have not yet had enough coffee, so sorry about that. I was on there for a second, and then I just trailed off so that guy that did that thing that I really liked it, and I can't remember his name because... Yeah.
Well, look, I can have 5 cups of coffee in me and still trail off exactly like that. So
trailing off is death. I mean, it's radio death.
I'm a professional podcast.
you got to keep it going.
Still happens, yeah. But, you must have had the temptation to drop what you were doing and become a touring musician, start recording in studio, get together a band and so on. But instead you chose to go to Berklee College of Music and study at that level. In fact, a few weeks ago I spoke with music YouTuber Rick Beato. I don't know if you're familiar with Rick Beato. But he has an incredible college audition story that he tells on his YouTube channel. Was there anything in particular that was harrowing about walking into the room to audition at Berklee, knowing that it's, Berklee, and all capital letters, huge?
It was, I actually auditioned at Juilliard. I didn't get in. And Manhattan School of Music, I did get in, just mm-hmm. as an alternate by the skin of my teeth. And Manus, those were the 3 big conservatories in New York. I really wanted to go to one of those. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to audition for Berklee. Basically, Berklee was more more of a Darwinian thing. Like, they'd let you in, and then you got humiliated out of there by not being a good player, but being surrounded by other good players. So there was like a 80% dropout rate in the first semester or something like that. Like everybody who couldn't cut it got, you know, it was like a big cutting contest. You know?
Yeah.
So I didn't have a Berklee audition. I had these week of auditions. I mean, they were extensive in New York. I took the bus in every day. I went to Juilliard. I remember these were the harrowing auditions that I walked into Juilliard, this room down in the basement somewhere in Lincoln Center, and I go in there, and there's like three old calcified dudes behind this table, and there's a Steinway piano, and it's really uncomfortably quiet, and I sit down, and the one guy goes, "Start with the Bach, please." Just like that. And I was like, oh God, I'm not going to be able to do this. And then Manhattan School of Music, it was in an auditorium, it was in a theater, and it was the three guys out in the middle of the theater. Mm-hmm. And on before me was this girl, she's probably my age, 17 or whatever, 18, beautiful, like just a beautiful girl in a white dress with a blue sack. I remember the whole thing, and she played like way better classical piano than I was ever going to be able to play. And I'm like, I got to go on after this, you know? And I got acne and... You know, awkward. Anyway, so she comes off, and I went out, and that was actually the one I got in. So I did all that, but then my best friend was going to Berklee, and I was not going to be able to afford to live in New York while going to... the dorms were so small at Manhattan School of Music that you couldn't really... Yeah. Like the first 20 people got a room, and that was it. Then you were on your own. So I was going to have to live in the town I grew up in and commute in every day. And I really, really, really wanted to get out of that town. Yeah. So I went to Berklee with my best friend, and we were roommates. And that's really how I went to Berklee. But it was good.
Yeah.
And at that point, I just started playing every night. Like I got a gig playing in this place. Like, you know, people would, it was like a piano bar and a, people would sit around. There was this one guy. Every night after he had had a certain amount of drinks, I'd finish a song and he'd say, "You suck," and that was like, and he just sat right there. And that was every night. The "you suck" guy was just, he just became part of my firmament.
So you're like, "Hey, shut up, Dad. You're not supposed to be here anyway."
Yeah, exactly. You're not supposed to be here.
Oh my God!
You're not my real dad.
Yeah, right, right. So you made it through Berklee. You never decided to walk away?
No, I actually got my degree in 3 years. I went summers.
Oh, like, incredible!
I wanted to finish, but I didn't want to be there any longer than I had to be there. So I got out. It was good. It was valuable.
Well, it sounds like while you were there, you were working on your 10,000 hours of live performing.
I was working. I was playing every night. I was doing the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I promised my parents I would finish college.
Right, you and know. So...
They were like, "We don't care what you do, just finish college. Just get your degree."
How do you go from that point to performing with guys like Ringo Starr and Bob Seger, Avril Lavigne, and so on? I mean,
It was all very gradual, you know? Yeah. I mean, I spent years in the trenches before I ever came close to anything like that.
Wow.
After college, I set out and had this band, and we toured all over the place. I moved to LA in 91, and you know, I played clubs, and I kind of got my whole solo act thing together, and I did really well. And then I started touring solo, and it wasn't till later that I ended up working with like famous people, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it must have been for a lot of famous people, you know. That wasn't the same as working with them, you know.
Must have been challenging in the early '90s with grunge being all the rage to be a piano player / keyboardist.
Yeah, and I was doing this whole kind of Dr. John meets Randy Newman meets Billy Joel kind of thing that was nothing about it was even remotely fashionable, and all these guys wanted to sign me, and you know, the marketing departments were like, we can't sell this. And I just kind of fell between the cracks, and I came really close. I got a publishing deal. Like it was, it never quite happened. And I just started to tour indie, you know, and it was right, you know, this is 94, 95, you know, 96. So you could, it was kind of the dawn of that era where you could really make a living without a record deal, just playing your own music.
Right.
I decided I was going to do this, label or not. And I was, you know, at up to that point, I was doing a lot of like cover band gigs or whatever stuff to make my rent, you know, and I was like, I have to stop doing this. Cause it just, you know, it's not, you can't be an artist and do this stuff every night.
Yeah.
So I just decided I was going to do, so I got on the road. I started opening for, you know, other acts and kind of listening rooms, these kind of rooms, music type places where people really listen to your songs and, you know, legit rooms. And I just got in a van and I drove all over the country for years.
Yeah.
Doing that and built up my following. And, you know, a lot of times there was no money. And if I put on a really great show, I would sell a lot of stuff. And that's how I was able to not sleep in my van. You know, I'd sell CDs and go to Motel 6, or if I didn't sell CDs, I'm like, I'm going to kill every night because I need to get a hotel room.
But as part of you going, this is kind of a romantic thing. This is what it means to be a working musician in the 90s.
I mean, I was happy. I was developing an audience for my songs. I mean, there's still nothing like singing some song that you wrote and is about your life and other people are singing along to it and they relate to it too.
You know, the thing
about a personal song is it has to be personal for other people. You know, that's when you've really succeeded.
Well, you have been able to connect unlike anything I've seen before with my listeners. And I was fortunate enough to get a copy of Good People and play it on my show. And the response has been overwhelming. So I would love to hear, you've obviously got your keyboard hooked up to your board and everything like that. So I'd love to hear a live rendition of Good People. This is a wonderful, wonderful song.
All right. Got some notes in it that I don't normally hit at this hour, so wish me,
okay, it's not too early for you?
Wish me luck. It's too early for me, but you know, okay. I've been on at 6 a.m. This is nothing.
All right, good.
Karen, she can't sleep at night. Tosses and turns till the morning light. The world's ugly, the world's not fair. She can't breathe through the hate in the air. Oh, right. And it's not easy to see, I know, when you finally run out of hope. But there's good people everywhere. I say there's good. It seems like someone's always getting in your face, shooting up the place, making you lose your faith in the human race. Just remember, there's good people everywhere. Karen, she wants to save the world. She tries hard, but she's just one girl. Now it's her who needs to be saved from a world going up in flames. You're feeling lost and afraid, I know, but believe me, you're not alone. But there's good. Oh, it is good. by surprise. Kindness in a stranger's eyes. Empathy, say it's in short supply, but it's out there. And there's good people everywhere. There's good people everywhere. There's good people everywhere. When it seems like someone's always getting in your face, shooting up the place, making you lose your faith in the human race.
Just incredible. Bob Malone. Holy crap. That is an absolute masterpiece. I love that song so much, Bob. It's just an incredible piece of music and so right for these times. I think that's one of the reasons why it resonated so much, I believe, with my audience, because it's so inspirational and it kind of counterpunches the notion of cynicism about, I mean, right now I think we're all going through a certain level of cynicism about our fellow countrymen, our fellow Americans, yeah, in terms of just everything that's happened the last 4 years, especially the last year.
Yeah, it's easy to go down that path, and mm-hmm. we're encouraged to go down that path, mm-hmm. you know, but a lot of this is from, you know, I get to travel a lot. Mm-hmm. To all of America, for one thing, and also you know, other countries, and you just, no matter where you go, whatever preconceived notion you have about a place, you know, most of the people you meet are wonderful. You know, you just that's most people.
Yeah, yeah, and I, you know, George Carlin, for example, always talks about how people as individuals are wonderful. Oftentimes, though, people in giant groups tend to not be so wonderful. Is that kind of your experience too, or are you noticing something different than that?
No, I mean, yeah, people individually, but I don't know. It just depends on where you go. Mm-hmm. I mean, as far as large groups of people, I see the people that come see me play and. You know, that's a certain kind of person that is going to buy a ticket to see me and come out there's good people everywhere. I try to say it in another way, but there it is. The song was me just blurting out stuff without trying to be fancy about it, you know, which is the hardest thing, of course.
Do you find
I could spiel off clever shit all day long and everyone's like, wow, you're so clever, but like, it's not the song that people want to hear over and over.
Okay, short break. We'll be back with more Bob Malone right after these words.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
The Bob Seska Show.
Do you find your audience is a close-knit group? Like you see some of the same faces all the time sitting in the front row, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, not quite that recognizable, but yeah, there's people that come to everything and mm-hmm. that have been coming for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, my online show, there's a core of people who have watched every, like I played every Tuesday in 2020. And there was this core of people who, like sometimes there was a lot more. Sometimes there was nights where it was just that core. And there was nights where a lot of other slightly more peripheral people would join in. But mm-hmm. there was that one kind of group of people that watched every week. I can't say how grateful I was to those those people. They they were just there, and I got to know all their either there were people that I did know their name personally, or I knew what their avatar name was, and they were all always there. But yeah, and live there's people that come to everything. You know, it's a little group. You know, it's my cult. You know, so to speak.
So you had to have been blown away being asked to perform with a Beatle. What was it like recording with Ringo Starr?
Yeah, well, in my formative discovering rock and roll years, like one of the very first things I discovered was the Beatles, you know, which was and Sergeant Pepper in particular.
Yeah.
And that was a good transition from me being this classical music guy, because had lots of interesting chord changes and lots of adventurous musical stuff was going on, you know. So anyway, I became a big Beatles freak, and nothing unusual there. But it was amazing. I remember I got the call that the guy who engineers for him had engineered my last record at the time, the one before this one. And he knew me, and he just calls me up. He's like, "Hey, man, do you want to do a session with Ringo?" He's like totally, like he sees him every day, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I set the phone down and I ran around in circles. Going, "Well, what's the money like, man?" You know, I didn't say that at all.
No, a
Beatle asked. Yeah. I never asked what it paid. It paid pretty good too.
Hey, you want to perform?
Best pay, yeah. Best pay I ever got for not asking. You know,
so, you're like, I'm being asked to perform with a Beatle. What's in it for me?
No, I got the check later. I was like, I totally forgot that this paid. I gave like zero shits about getting money for this. So I just, he's like, "Okay, cool, man. You know, it's Monday. It's at Ringo's house." I'm like, "Ringo's house."
Ringo's house.
Which was in a Hollywood Hills, like it took me 10 minutes to get to Ringo's house.
Right.
I remember I come home and tell my wife and she's all excited. And then we have Ringo's address. So we look it up like in Google Maps and you can see the gate, right? And the garbage can. And she's like, "That's Ringo's garbage can." And I was like, OMG, it's Ringo's garbage can. Anyway, so I went over there and went up the driveway, pulled into the big, you know, the big seven car lot. And it was like the giant peace and love sculpture.
Wow.
That was really cool. And I walked over to the wing of the house that had the studio in it and went in, and Ringo appeared, and he was just really nice person. Knew exactly what he wanted musically.
Yeah.
And I could tell, you know, the thing about the Beatles is people whose origin story, like all these famous rockers from the 70s, they all have the same origin story, which is I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. So to all these people who have become huge stars, they're still in awe of the Beatles, you know? Mm-hmm. And then a guy like me is in extra awe, you know? So my point was he really went to great lengths to put you at ease, you know? He was very friendly, and he kind of knows that his status, you know, in the whole thing, and he just makes you comfortable so you can... Because part of me is like, I couldn't just do a normal session. Like, it was... You know, in a way, it was a normal session. I came to play a tune, and you know, but you're just like, you can't get over that it's Ringo, you know?
right.
So anyway, I start playing, and everything's going great. And then there was this spot where I did a fancy lick, and Ringo like nods in approval, and then I fucked up immediately because I was like, he liked it. Ah!
See, I always love to hear stories like that because you know, I've talked to other musicians who have played with, you know, sort of A-listers in their careers. And I always say, well, were you nervous going in? And like, no, it was a piece of cake. I went right in. I blasted through it. And that was it. Like Rick Beato. Yeah, I did a session with this and this guy and that guy. And it was no problem. I walked out. And it was a great success. But I love to hear reality that it is nerve-wracking to be in that position.
It's really, to be honest, it was only like I've played with a lot of other famous people and none of it was nerve-wracking like this was.
Mm.
You know, which this would just felt different than any other people. I mean, I was in awe of the other famous people I've played with
and
I loved them, but I wasn't nervous so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to explain. Like I knew I know I can do the gig. But it was just, you know, a Beatle.
Right, that's just it.
It's not the same plane of existence as other mere mortal rock musicians.
Right, well, meantime, I mean, you had performed on stage with Springsteen, Jackson Browne, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, Jimmy Buffett. How did you end up hooking up with John Fogerty, and how did that relationship manage to last as long as it has?
I got the call. We had a mutual colleague.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, John Fogerty fired his keyboard player and they're looking for a new guy. And I've been really just hyping you up to give you a call. So you probably will hear from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear from them. And 6 months went by and nothing happened, which is mostly what happens in show business. Somebody tells you something's going to happen, it doesn't happen. So I didn't really think too hard about it. I just went on about my life.
Yeah.
And I got 6 months later, out of the blue, I get this email asking if I want to come audition for John. And I'm like, sure, no problem. And I was really excited about that. So I went back. It was funny. I was like, I'm going to learn all the songs. I'm going to learn all the hits. Mm-hmm. And I go, and every single one of them, I'm playing along. I'm like, oh, I know this song. Everybody knows this song. I know how this goes while it's happening. I don't have to learn anything. So aside from what parts do it, anyway, the point was they're just timeless, you know, and they're embedded in us, these songs. And so I show up, and Bob Fogerty, who's John's brother, he kind of runs the operation. And Julie, his wife, who manages him, and they were there. It was John's. It was their house up in Hollywood Hills.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff was set up in the garage, and they had like the guitar tech was playing guitar, and his two sons were playing bass and drums, and they had like a Hammond organ there for me to play. So I start playing and. And they had not heard of me, and they really wanted someone they knew, I think. And they weren't counting on liking it, you know?
Hmm.
So Julie's watching me play, and I play a couple songs. She's getting more and more excited. She, like, tapes me on her iPhone, and she's like, hold on a second. She goes in the house, and she's in there for what seemed like hours. It was probably, 10 minutes or something. And she comes back out with John. Oh. And then I played a couple more songs for him, and that was it. He's like, you want the gig? We're going to Russia next week.
Wow.
Yeah, we did a couple of gigs in the Midwest, like almost immediately after I got the job. And then we went to Russia. That was and played for 300,000 people in Kazan, Russia. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I imagine part of your appeal and maybe what appealed to John Fogerty about you and certainly his wife is the fact that not only can you play, but you've got amazing stage presence. And that's something that you can bring to the table as well that not a lot of guys can do. How did you end up developing that? Did that just come naturally for you that you could command an audience?
Not naturally at all. I mean, I was bad at it at first.
Hmm.
I always loved the idea of being entertaining. Like
there
are people who can just stand there and not move and are so magnetic that they're entertaining.
Yeah.
But I was not exactly that kind of presence, and I was stuck behind a piano. Like you can't walk around with it, you can't go anywhere. And which is good because every time I've ever tried to stand up and sing, like I would trip over shit and, you know, I'd get lost and walk off the edge of the stage. Like I was born to just stay in one place.
Right, right. Yeah.
You know, and, but and playing live is like being a great musician or singer or whatever is secondary to your ability to command a room, you mm-hmm. know, and I watched other people in the way they could own a room. It's essential because yeah. they will go in your direction if you can own them. And it's all about just how you present yourself and what you say. And it's a vibe. And you know when it's happening, you know when they're yours and you can now bend them to your will. And so I used to, like early 90s, I used to videotape. I had this video VCR camera and I used to tape every show and then just watch it.
Yeah.
And slowly eliminate stupid shit that I had done from my set and then emphasize stuff that worked, you know, because you can't always tell when you're doing it. You have to see it, and when you see it, with that which is embarrassing becomes painfully clear right away.
Do you have a lot of Spinal Tap moments as you're looking back?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. You know, like that. There was that time I couldn't get out of my pod. You know, and I had that.
Yeah, that'd be hilarious. Suddenly, John Fogerty starts incorporating scenery and props on his shows. You're in a pod.
So by the time I got to Fogerty, I'd been doing my solo show for 15 years or mm-hmm. whatever, 20 years.
Yeah.
And I knew, you know, I had all of it together. So I had showmanship and I loved it, entertaining.
Yeah.
And that was a bonus besides being able to play. And he loved that I really had roots music knowledge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He would like, you know, he asked me to play some stuff. He wanted to hear like a Ray Charles thing and, you know, see if I knew what that was and how to play. And I was like, oh, I'm into that. New Orleans kind of, you know. Yeah, he loves stuff.
Wow,
like that.
Wow. And but, you know, Ray Charles is notoriously difficult to play, isn't it?
I don't know if it's difficult. I mean, no one can sound like him. He was just such an amazing singer, but it's just a style that I think everybody should immerse themselves in for a while. You know, like he kind of invented soul music, and he took the music from the church and put secular lyrics to it, you know? And then later in his career, he sang all kinds of music. Like, he had the same kind of eclectic thing that I love, you know, he was, you know, he did that country record, but he just made everything sound like Ray Charles, you know, that was the point of it all. But, you know, he loves roots music, and he's got encyclopedic knowledge of it.
Huh.
So, you know, when you play with people who are famous, like, they expect that you're going to show up knowing their songs, but they really want you to like what they like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm like this too when I hire other musicians. Like, okay, you're going to learn my song, but do you know where I'm coming from? Do you like what I like? You know, and the vibe is totally different when that person has the same kind of musical background knowledge, whatever you want to call it, that you have. There's just a more sympathetic kind of melding.
Right.
So it was like that. He wanted to know if I dug what he dug, basically.
Oh yeah, sure.
That was part of it. I mean, they were short on time, so they had to hire me, but you know. And then at first I was just in the back playing at organ, and I think they were just, Julie was watching me do showmanship type stuff. John didn't care, his back was to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He just wanted to know, he liked the parts I was playing. So
yeah.
It became, I got more and more kind of featured as the years went by. And I kept the gig for so long by just, you know, I keep my mouth shut.
Well, it also must be gratifying to be doing solo work at the same time. Because imagine a lot of guys who end up with a touring musician like John Fogerty would be tempted to maybe not do their own stuff and just kind of fall back on that one gig. But you've been touring for two decades on your own as well as John Fogerty.
He doesn't do enough gigs that I would just live off of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and musically, I wouldn't want to just do one gig. Like, as much as I love, and I really love his songs, I mm-hmm. love playing with him. I was a huge fan way before any of this ever happened.
Do you have to trigger the hand clap sound at the beginning of Center Field?
Is that no, Kenny Aronoff does okay. that. He's got a little pad. And I usually what I do is I try to make eye contact with him, and then I clap all off time.
You know, to try I'm to. Sure, he loves that.
Yeah, it's just become a long running in joke. I'm like.
There you go.
Anyway, it's never thrown him off. He's a rock.
Well, before we wrap up, because I see we're running long now, I gotta hear the forthcoming single, "The River Gives." That drops a week from Friday on April 30th, right?
It does.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, sorry, I got off mic there. "The River Gives" comes out on the 30th.
Yeah, and that'll also be on "Good People" as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Wonderful.
Okay. Ready?
Yep.
Okay. Good.
Think I know, sooner or later, river bank gonna overflow. The river gives, the river takes away. You can't stop the waters rise, you can only pray. The river gives, oh, the river takes away. We live day to day. Now the water swept away everything I've known. I stand on a ruin that was once my home. Nothing but nothing, far as my eye can see. Can't help but wonder what will become of me. The river gives, all the river takes away. You can't stop the waters rise, you can only pray. The river gives, oh, the river takes away. We'll be back again, but we won't be alone, 'cause this is our home. This is our home. The river gives, the river takes away. You can't stop, the waters rise, you can only pray. River takes away. Down here by the river, we live day to day. All right.
All right. Another masterpiece. Holy crap. That is "The River Gives," your forthcoming single, dropping on April 30th. My God, Bob, when did you discover you could sing too? I mean, it's one thing to be really great on keyboards, piano, etc., but to combine that with vocals is extraordinarily rare. I mean, when did you just start doing it once you discovered rock? Or
I started doing it. It was terrible. I was bad at it for a long time. Some people still say I'm bad at it.
No.
I had kind of... You know, I wasn't a natural at singing. I just wanted to sing so badly that I just kept hammering away at it until I was able to come up with something that worked. That was basic. Yeah. That's basically my singing. Like, I had the instrument I had to work with was not the greatest, and I just kind of, I sang a lot until I did a ton of crappy bar gigs in my youth, and mm-hmm. those were the best thing that ever happened to me because, I sang 4 hours a night, and it really allowed me to fail, not on a big stage where it mattered, to just kind of learn and get better, learn how to work a crowd, learn how to sing effectively, and all of those things happened kind of off the radar in tiny little places.
Yeah, your vocals remind me a lot of another indie musician that we love to play on the show, Michael McDermott, who's also represented by Mike Farley. And Michael's one of my favorites. And you guys both have very similar voices. In fact, I'm just going to throw this seed out there. I'd love to hear a collaboration between you and Michael McDermott. I think that would be an outstanding duet.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. But, one of your other collaborators, Trisette, is on my playlist as well. How did you end up?
Awesome.
How'd you end up hooking up with her?
She, my wife is a musician. Mm-hmm. She's a public defender and a musician. When I met her, she was traveling the folk circuit playing solo. She just got real burnt out on the music business.
They're a dime a dozen, those musicians / lawyers.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, she always wanted. She wanted to help people. She wanted to. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so she. But she got invited to play this festival in the UK.
Yeah.
It was right when her back went out, and she was going to have back surgery, and she was in tremendous pain, and she wasn't going to go. Like, she was in so much pain. And I'm like, well, if you don't go, you're going to be depressed, and you're never, you're going to regret not going.
Yeah.
And if you go, you're going to be in pain, but you'll have gone. If you don't go, you're also going to be in pain, but regretting having not gone. So you might as well go. Mm-hmm. So we bundled her up and got her to the airport. She went to England to play. So she knew a guy that she had met on MySpace, this musician, and he had helped hook her up with some extra gigs to kind of round out the festival gig. And his friend was Trisette, who was living in London at the time.
Yeah.
And Trisette and her ex-boyfriend, Mick, was this great bass player. They were both from Australia, and they were both living in London. And Karen shows up, and they know all of her songs. They're ready to go, background vocals. And so he had put a band together for her. So they did the gigs, and the gigs were great, and everyone became really good friends. And they met, and then Trisette and Mick moved back to Australia, where they're from. And I toured, especially like... Over the last, 15 years, I've done like 10 tours of Australia, and so I was going there every year at that point.
Yeah.
And so I started using them on my tour to, be in a band. And Karen would come along for some of them. And we all just became really great friends. And Trisette really wanted to come to America.
Mm-hmm.
So she started coming here, and she'd like live with us for a few months at a time and go home. And she finally got her visa to stay here and play music. And so she started working with my band all the time. Like, she's all over these recordings that are on my last two records. And then I got her on a John Fogerty gig for 2019. They added background singers.
Oh, that's great.
And so she's just been, and she plays piano, so I love having her open for me because you don't have to move any shit,
Yeah, right.
Like, the worst thing is having to move the piano, You get it set there, and it's large and heavy, and, you know, it's never right after they move it.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know, yeah, yeah.
All she had to do is sit down and play my piano. That's, you know.
Yeah, I find anyway. Talented musicians often attract other talented musicians. It's strange the way that works.
Oh, yeah. You can't really be friends with somebody who sucks. It's because right, it'll come up at some point. And if you're really a friend, you're not going to lie about it. Or I don't know. It's hard to explain, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why there's so many bad breakups with members of bands, where you have to kick someone
like
out of the band.
Karen, yeah, like if Karen was beautiful and smart, but if she had been a bad songwriter, I don't think... Like, she told me, she's like, it doesn't matter. If you had been a bad songwriter, no way I would have married you. You
know? Oh, Karen's your wife, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Karen's okay. My wife, right.
Oh,
anyway,
that's wonderful.
That's the Trizzy story, and she's just a wonderful person.
Do you have one more? Do you have time for one more question, Bob? Because I want to ask you about something. And you know, I don't know if this is a sore subject, but it's one thing that I've observed a lot. And in fact, you know, I mentioned Rick Beato earlier, and something I talked about with him. It must be difficult being a session musician now in the age of sampling and so much digital music where people can just sit and drop samples into a timeline. Are you running up against that? How are you able to break through it? What do you think of all of it?
I mean, being a session guy is kind of a bonus to... I would say my main living was always going and doing my own songs and touring they can't really take that away from me.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? Like, that's my own personal commodity that nobody else can sell.
Mm-hmm.
And the session work just kind of happened over time and crept up on me. I'm not like, you know, I'm in LA where I'm still, for sessions, I'm still competing with like amazing people that I grew up listening to, you know?
Yeah.
And I get a fair amount of session work. And yeah, it's different. I mean, it's different for everybody. There's less of it. And yeah, a lot of people just work at home. You know, the styles have changed.
Mm-hmm.
But to be honest, when I started, that was already in motion. Like the late 80s was when drum machines were happening. Like I remember you would go into some club or hotel lobby, and that was the beginning of some dude with a guitar and like a sequencer, right?
Yeah.
He had like everything was canned.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the music. Whereas a few years before that, before I had entered the music business, you had to hire actual players, right? So it all really began 30 some years ago. So that's the kind of the environment I came up in. But I could always play and sing by myself. And I never went in for the canned stuff. I was like, if I have to do that, I'll just quit before I have to do that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but I could do a really entertaining show, just sit down and play and sing and rock and just do it by myself.
That's right.
So, but that all started back then, you know? So I've always kind of come up in that environment, you know? There was always, you know, the prevalence of home recording happened more, you know, starting around the beginning of the 2000s, like when Pro Tools, I can remember this transitional period in the 90s where you were still recording onto, at that point, 2-inch tape had disappeared, and you were recording onto, I can't remember what it was, to ADATs.
Oh, yeah.
It's this kind of digital tape, you know? And everyone was using that. And if you had a budget, they'd bring in the Pro Tools guy, who was the specialized person who knew how to use Pro Tools.
Right.
And it was, and like, so you'd get a take and it was really good, but you missed this one chord, was a little off. And I'd be like, oh, let me just punch in that one chord. And the Pro Tools guy's like, no, I got it. And he'd just move it. And you're like, oh my God, you don't have to be good anymore. They can just fix it.
You're right.
So that all happened. Then once everybody could afford and have Pro Tools, then that changed the world, because now all you needed was your laptop and you could record legit sounding music. You know, you didn't need to go to the studio anymore. I still went because I like to cut my rhythm section live, and you know, it depends on what kind of stuff you're going to do, but
yeah,
that all changed. And I don't know. I mean, I, of course, the people that call me are not the people that are using samples and doing that sort of thing. You know, they're old school people who want a player, you know?
Yeah, right.
Right. So I'm one of the guys they call when they want that kind of thing.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that's always going to be a commodity, Bob. I think there's limitations to using a lot of samples where you're kind of stuck, and with the obvious other downside of duplicating the same sample that maybe some other recording artist threw into their song as well. There's nothing particularly unique about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, there are lots of people doing really unique stuff with it and really cool stuff. It's just a different way of making music, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, there's stuff I hear all the time, and I don't necessarily like the production. I don't like the sound of it. It's not for me. I'm not the target audience, but I often hear a great song there. I'm like, it's still a great song.
Right.
It may not sound like what we're used to.
Yeah.
The biggest downside is presenting that live. Some people they make these very programmed sounding kind of records, and when they play live, if they use players, sometimes they use players triggering electronic sounds, but it still have that live player energy. And people that sing to tracks, it's just weird. Like, there's no energy.
Yeah, yeah.
With that,
there's no spontaneity or organic flavor to
it. You're just not feeling it. Yeah. You know, I understand that some of those productions are very hard to replicate with players because it's just they go about it in a radically different way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, that started in the '80s. I remember if you were playing Top 40 in '85, '86, when I kind of was, just started playing. It became increasingly difficult for live bands to replicate the records that were coming out because they were programmed, they were using samples, they were using all kinds of stuff that was not played by people. And so, those kind of gigs, the whole idea was to sound exactly like the record.
Yeah.
You know, so when you played Proud Mary, you could sound exactly like the record, you know what I mean?
Right.
But when you played the stuff that was coming out at the time, it was incredibly hard to sound like the record. Nobody did. It almost became like people were giving up on. Now they can. Because the difference was that technology was kind of expensive then. And people who had record deals and were in studios and stuff could do it. But you couldn't always necessarily replicate that on stage with some average bar band.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's been an ongoing phenomenon for a long time. Like, I listen to some of these 80s records. There's this station they play at my gym. It's got this weird format. It's like new stuff and 80s, like dance 80s stuff.
Wow.
And nothing in between, nothing before or nothing from the 90s. Nothing, like, it's just weird, but it's amazing how that stuff holds together. Like, those records from now often just fit right in with those kind of synth pop records that got made back then.
Oh, yeah. Everything old is new again. You know what I mean?
Like, they really are the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I've been living with that my whole life, basically.
Right,
my
right.
Whole working life. Yeah.
Well, Bob,
but I just kind of decided I wanted to be... I just detached myself from having to worry about that and just went for the kind of organic thing that I like to do, and I just do it. Okay.
That sounds like the best, absolutely the best approach to take, and it's obviously been quite successful for you. And I have to say, in addition to being an amazing singer, songwriter, keyboardist, session player, performing with all these people, you're an amazing podcast guest. I have to just say, because you're funny, the songs were incredible. What a blast. Thank you so much for being on.
No problem.
The new single is called The River Gives, available everywhere you get your digital music on April 30th, a week from this Friday. The new album is called Good People, and the website is bobmalone.com. Links in the description for everything. Thank you so much, Bob. Come back on the show anytime you want. You have an open invitation. I'd love to talk with you more about all of
Excellent.
This stuff. Yeah.
Like, I'm going to call you tomorrow.
Great.
Just kidding.
Not a problem. I have another show tomorrow, so you're welcome.
I'm gonna go out to DC and stalk you.
All right, good. I'll keep an eye on the shrubs outside the house.
Yeah. keep an eye on the shrubs.
Yeah.
You never know what's in there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, my friend. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
You bet.